This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand, and we welcome our listeners around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney. Europe correspondent Declan Hughes joins me now from Dublin. Welcome to the show, Declan.
Good to be back, Henry.
How is Dublin's fair city these days?
Dublin's fair city is a mixed bag. I mean, we have a number of issues. We have a serious shortage of housing, and that is being reflected in the numbers of domestic homeless on the streets of Dublin. But we now have a new phenomenon where refugees who are coming here to seek asylum, there's nowhere to put them. And they're now living in tents on the sides of streets. A classic example is there's a government building on Mount Street, which has a kind of a laneway down into it off Mount Street proper. Mm-hmm. And on the what the Americans call the sidewalk on the way down the laneway, there are loads and loads of tents where most of the people in the tents are asylum seekers, and because the state has run out of accommodation to provide them with. We're seeing a huge phenomenon now whereby hoteliers are accepting bids from the Department of Integration, I think they're called, and the hotels are shutting down and being turned into asylum seeker centres. And this has caused a lot of resentment in certain parts of the country, where in some cases the only hotel in town has shut down and most of the locals that work there have lost their jobs. And the hotel is now being used to house asylum seekers, which effectively puts the town off the map from a tourism point of view, and also the ancillary businesses that that would rely on the tourists are suffering, because the asylum seekers are getting very, very small amounts of money to live on, so they're not able to contribute to the economy because they don't have anything to contribute. And this is causing a lot of resentment, and that's another part of the problem. So, and we've seen this phenomenon now, is there are small right-wing movements springing up all over the place, and we've seen old derelict buildings that are being suspected of being used in the future for asylum seekers and migrants from overseas are being torched, and there's been a spate of arson attacks on this kind of accommodation across the country. And there was a really bad example of this in Dublin over the Christmas holidays, whereby there was an old bar which was going to be used, and it was actually going to be used to house homeless Irish, but the rumour got out in the district that it was going to be used for asylum seekers, and the thing was torched.
Oh my God. Now, this fascinates me, Declan, because I haven't lived in Ireland since the 1980s, and we certainly didn't have a situation where there was lots of immigrants coming in to the country. So it seems kind of strange to me, you know, living in Australia. What's even stranger to me is the headline that I read in the Irish Independent. €20,000 was spent on deportation flights for one asylum seeker. One asylum seeker, as a total for last year reached €269,045.
Yeah, well, the situation with asylum seekers is, again, I have an insight into this because one of the times I was working about 20 odd years ago, I was on loan to the Department of Justice, who were responsible for organising deportations. Now, cost was never a factor. We had to assess each file on its merits. So, you know, you'd have case A, and he had no reason to be here. He didn't satisfy the basic criteria of what an asylum seeker should be. But what you'd have to do is you process the deportation order. They would have to send a Garda with the asylum seeker to make sure that he got off at the other end, so to speak. Mm. And then the Garda would have to be brought back from the third country. And frequently, a lot of the expense involved is the Garda might have to wait 2 or 3 days on the other side to get a connecting flight back to a European hub where he can get a connecting flight back to Dublin. And that is part of the cost of that. But also, they sometimes have to charter a plane if they have enough asylum seekers, they will charter a plane, which actually perversely brings down the cost of per individual, if you know what I mean, because you have 15, 20 or 100 asylum seekers heading to the same destination. But this is, again, part of the problem. The ones who, shall we say, don't qualify under any grounds and have no business being here at all and have to be deported, they don't all come from the one location. So it's difficult. You have to get individual flights for each two or three sometimes, and sometimes individual one. And you have to send a Garda with them to make sure that they get off at the appointed place. Now, as far as I know, they're handed over to the local police force to make sure they don't get back on the plane. But as I said, the local the Irish police officer has to go with them, and sometimes another person has to accompany them as well, depending on whether the person concerned has a history of violence while they were here or not. And that's part of the reason why it's so expensive. But yeah, everything that involves a state seems to cost oodles of money, whether it's building a motorway, erecting a building or whatever. If the state gets involved, it always seems to cost more money. I'm not 100% sure why that is, but, you know, there's the rub.
Yeah, and it's interesting that some of these people are being sent business class travel. I mean, you know, amongst the most expensive flights I'm reading in the Irish Independent, $18,758 was spent last September taking a failed asylum seeker back to their home country of Mozambique. I mean, this is absurd stuff to me. I mean, even we in Australia send them back, but it doesn't cost that kind of money.
But I was going to say, it takes so long usually to process a deportation order that if they decide to send somebody back on Friday, maybe the only seats left on the plane are business class, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course. It's very strange circumstances. You know, in Australia, I think we send them back on their boats, quite frankly, on probably better boats. We don't fly them back. I mean, I've never heard of a situation. Do they do that in Britain?
Well, I don't know whether you're familiar with the policies of the last two or three Home Secretaries in Britain, but Priti Patel, who ironically is from Asian stock that were deported out of Uganda under Idi Amin and arrived in Britain in the 1970s, was one of the staunchest people advocating this policy. The British wanted to send their failed asylum seekers to Rwanda and signed a deal with the Rwandan government. Now, Britain never ruled Rwanda. So what you're doing is you're sending people who are looking to resettle in Britain to a country where English isn't even the spoken language. The most popularly spoken foreign language in Rwanda is French, because they were ruled by the Belgians.
Mm.
And at a time when the Wallonians, that's the French-speaking Belgians, were predominantly the population. It's completely flipped over in Belgium now. The Dutch speakers are in the majority. But when they were a colonial power, French was the lingua franca, literally, of the colonialism. And so this is a thing. And the British were prepared to send people to Rwanda that were coming over in the small boats across the channel.
Mm. Gosh. Okay, now, look, I want to talk about Alexei Navalny. The US President Joe Biden said if he died, there would be consequences. Now, obviously, he has been, according to Al Jazeera, brutally murdered. Of course, Al Jazeera will have this left-wing angle on everything. But they say world reacts to Alexei Navalny's death in prison. Tell me, I think you know a lot about this. Do you think that America will step up to the plate with this, along with Britain and obviously Australia and Ireland? What are your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that the Americans are going to have to do is, this is against the backdrop of the Ukrainians having lost one of their cities to the Russians in the war. Mm. And all these events are kind of interconnected. Putin has an election coming up in a few weeks. And interestingly enough, his most popular opponent, shall we say, who was serving a life sentence for some ridiculous charge, mysteriously gets what they called sudden adult death syndrome in prison.
Yeah,
very convenient, don't you think?
What is it called? Sudden death syndrome is what it's called. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm sure it was sudden, all right.
But we know this phenomenon over here as sudden adult death syndrome. What you get the case with sudden adult death syndrome, it's usually seen among athletes. Now, you know me in sport, but this is an insight to you. Seemingly fit young athletes suddenly drop dead with a heart attack for no apparent reason.
So it is a real thing, yeah.
It's a real thing, absolutely. But the Russian prison of authorities are saying that that's what killed Mr. Navalny. Now, a man of 47 years of age, you know, who has incidentally survived a previous attempt to poison him. It's amazingly coincidental that suddenly he drops dead from this syndrome.
Mm, of course, it is. Everyone's, people have views on this, and You know, I'm just wondering if Biden is actually going to do what he said, there will be consequences.
One of the things they could try and do is, one, that they'll probably end up approving the latest arms deal to the Ukrainians, but that's one consequence. But the other thing they could do is they could ramp up economic sanctions against Russia. Like, for example, I'm not sure what the Americans are currently importing from Russia, but just import nothing from Russia. That's the only thing they can do in a diplomatic sense of the word, because Russia is now running out of people to trade with. There's a handful of countries that are standing by Russia, but one or two of them are big enough to provide Russia with an export market, so to speak. And they're mostly in Asia, funnily enough, the people that are trading with Russia.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where this is going. I mean, you know, as you said, it's interlinked with a lot of other events, particularly in Europe. You know, the whole business of Ukraine. It's interesting how these things all connect, Declan.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is interesting. But one of the things that's going around the place, and again, there's been rumors going around on the internet and other places. Now, I know the internet's not the most reliable source of information, but one of the most interesting rumors going around about Putin is that Putin is allegedly terminally ill. And that is alleged. He was allegedly diagnosed with it before his first invasion of the Ukraine around 2014. So that is possibly motivating him to a degree, if that's a true story. Now, again, it may not be true, but a lot of the rumors about Vladimir Putin tend to be true. That's the reason why I mentioned it in the first place. There's an issue now between Navalny's family and the prison authorities, because they haven't released the corpse to them yet as of Monday. So, and again, the prison authorities say, oh, we want to establish a cause of death, you know, definitively before we release the body. But again, the Navalny's mother and widow are obviously complaining about not having the body released. But also the widow came out over the weekend, apparently, and pointed the finger directly at Putin's regime.
She'll have to watch for her own life.
Absolutely, because do you remember that leader of the rebel army that turned back and decided not to launch an assault on Moscow in the end?
Yes,
and his plane mysteriously crashed.
Yes.
You know, these things tend to have happened. You know, this reminds me of that old joke of the Soviet Union era, whereby in 1950, Joseph Stalin was woken up by one of his aides. Mr. Stalin, the terrible news. What is it? Next year's election results have been stolen, sir.
I want to stay in the Middle East because, you know, it's funny. If you look at what's going on with Ukraine and Russia, it sort of went... Zelensky wasn't being listened to for a while when, you know, Israel forced their way, came back at the Gaza Strip when they attacked people in Israel. And it's interesting, they're back now. But let's talk about, you know, the Israeli forces in Gaza. Al Jazeera again reports they kill, wound Palestinians waiting for food aid in Gaza. What is the problem with... I mean, there are a lot of these people are stuck in the southern border, but Egypt won't let them in. What is the story? Why has Israel got a problem with giving them food, or is there other technical issues getting trucks in there?
Well, you see, one of the problems is the Israeli army is now in control of about 75 or 80% of the land area of the Gaza Strip.
Yes.
And what you have is Rafah, which is the biggest town near the border post with Egypt, normally had a population of about 200,000. And now there's about 1.75 million Gazans living in tents in or around Rafah. And the city itself has been, you know, hit by airstrikes. So a lot of the buildings in Rafah are in rubble. So you have native Rafans, so to speak, living in tented accommodation. You have all these refugees who were told by the Israelis to move south. We're going to be dealing with the Hamas in the north, move south. So they did as they were told and they moved south. And now they're being attacked again. And this is Israel's last big sweep to get rid of Hamas, as they see it. But one of the interesting things about Gaza is Gaza seems to have more tunnels than the catacombs of Rome.
Yes.
It looks like they could have if they'd been smart enough about it, they could have built an entire underground city in the Gaza Strip and allowed the Israelis bomb the buildings above, and nobody would have been hurt if they'd organized it properly. But again, we don't know what sort of long-term thinking Hamas does in regards to that. And again, Hamas doesn't seem to have much regard for the citizenry of Gaza, who aren't members of Hamas, because they have this nasty tendency to put their weapons and stuff under schools and under hospitals and things like that. Mm. And then the Israelis come in, having bombed a hospital, and then they open up the tunnels underneath, and hey, presto, there's loads of weapons. You know, so it kind of, just when you think Israel is totally the bad guy here, the evidence for some of their bad behavior that might justify it philosophically in the minds of certain people appears to be there. Now, I'm not saying for one minute that the Israelis are planting the stuff there, but there might be a small element of it, but not the volume of stuff that they're finding. There wouldn't be enough time to plant it.
It's interesting to note that, you know, the Israelis that were taken into Gaza, they were feeding them very well by comparison to the citizens. The Israeli hostages were being fed so much better. There's something not right about that.
No, that's very true. But then again, Hamas were in control of the food supplies to the Israeli hostages, whereas the residents were relying on what little UN aid is able to get in. And this is basically the problem. They don't allow many trucks in, and the trucks that do come in, it's a drop in the ocean to what's required. I don't honestly know what the solution is. And Egypt used to rule the Gaza Strip, and what happened was originally Israel invaded it, and then it became part of the proposed two-state solution to be part of Palestinian territory. It reminds me a little bit, although on a much smaller geographical scale, of what used to be the case back in the day when there was an East Pakistan and a West Pakistan. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. You're the historian here.
Bangladesh, which became independent in 1971, was from 1947 to 1971 East Pakistan, and it was 700 miles from the main part of Pakistan.
Right. I did not know this.
Yeah. And the reason why Bangladesh got its independence, this is really funny. Pakistan is, as you know, a predominantly Muslim state, as is Bangladesh. The Eastern Pakistanis didn't like the way the Western Pakistani government was behaving and appealed for assistance. And the Indians, who are predominantly Hindu, came to the aid of the East Pakistanis and helped establish the independent Bangladesh state. And there was a war fought between Pakistan and India over it. And at the end of it, Bangladesh got its independence.
The irony of it all. United Nations, the experts there are expressing alarm over reports of alleged human rights violations in Gaza and the West Bank, particularly amongst women and girls. You know, you have to wonder it is a kind of a trademark of every war where there's rape going on. This is not new. But it is alarming that this is happening, you know?
Yes, it is. And again, from, you know, I don't know why women are made to suffer in wars like this. I mean, okay, if a woman signs up to join the Israeli army and gets shot, that's one thing. If a woman signs up to join the Ukrainian army and gets shot in a war, that's another thing. But why they're made to suffer like this is there's no justification for it whatsoever.
Yes, and it's interesting because these soldiers, they're obviously in high stress mode, the kind of actions they're doing are just horrific when I think about it, and there's no excuse for it. I want to bring Qatar into this. Now, they've criticised Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu over the Hamas comments. They accuse him of seeking to prolong Israel's war on Gaza. It has to be said he probably is until he gets rid of Hamas, Declan.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about this whole situation is the government in the West Bank part of Palestine are from the Fatah movement, who were led by the late Yasser Arafat. And they're relatively quiet because they don't have much time for Hamas themselves. Mm. And this is going to solve their problem in a sense. But they're getting one of the beneficiaries of this Israel-Gaza situation is going to be the Fatah regime in the West Bank, because that'll be one of their troubled one of their trouble spots quelled when the dust finally settles. So it's amazing to see how the benefits of one person's action can benefit somebody else without them having to lift a finger, so to speak. Qatar, to be fair to them, have worked as honest brokers in trying to negotiate a couple of pauses. I'm loath to use the term ceasefire, because if you use the term ceasefire, the Israelis will say, no way, we're not doing a ceasefire, but we might do a pregnant pause. But any pauses that have been organised so far have been done with the goodwill of the Qatari government and the Egyptian government, who still, since the days of Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin's peace agreement in 1977, have had reasonably clear channels of communication with the Israeli government. And that's, I suppose, again, a legacy from those diplomatic moves made by those two leaders back in the late 70s, early 80s. Poor old Sadat, of course, as we remember, was an innocent bystander in an attempt to assassinate the Irish Defence Minister Jimmy Tully way back in 1981.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, I was reading about. I was a newsreader at that time, and I did read about that. Now, if you've just joined us, it's Henry from Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia. I'm talking with Declan Hughes, our Europe correspondent in Dublin, in Ireland. And in a minute, we'll talk about the arrests and arson during Eritrean festival riots in The Hague. But I just wanted to sort of get another handle on this. I'm just trying to find this. I've got so much stuff open here. Norway is helping to transfer tax funds frozen by Israel to Palestinian Authority. Everyone's getting into the game here, aren't they? I mean, Israel has been withholding tax revenues, obviously earmarked for the PA, amid Tel Aviv's brutal war in Gaza.
Yeah, and...
Why is Norway involved in this? I just find it really odd.
Well, again, there are. It's kind of like, how would I describe this? Every time the Israelis' foreign policy is criticised, the defence of the current regime is anti-Semitism. Mm. It's like, you know, they seem to think that because of all the horrible things done to their ancestors, it gives them carte blanche to do whatever they like, and you know that's. That's completely unacceptable. And again, I think it's ironic that they're behaving in the manner that people behaved towards them hundreds of years ago, or even decades ago. You know, like two
hugely
wrongs don't
ironic.
Make a right.
Hugely yeah. ironic. Yeah.
Two wrongs don't make a right. Now, obviously the Hamas were firing rockets on Israel repeatedly for a long, long time, and Israel responded in its usual manner, like, you know. Myself and a couple of friends wrote a comedy sketch once, which was a lampoon of the arms race, and it's two little boys. One says, "I've got a catapult," and then the other fella tops what he has, and then it builds up eventually, and they end up saying, "I've got a nuclear weapon," and blah blah blah. And that's kind of like it was like an allegory about the arms race. And again, it's kind of like Hamas fires a rocket at Israel. Israel fires four rockets back at Gaza, you know, and that was used to be the way things were done. So obviously this current crisis is the culmination of lots and lots of to and fro with rocket attacks from Israel and from Gaza going in both directions. And so this current denouement is Netanyahu's attempt to wipe that out once and for all.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, the whole business of Europe getting involved makes me a little bit nervous. You know, you mentioned earlier on in our broadcast that, you know, this is very complicated. And I'm wondering, you know, is Israel being criticised more than Hamas on the world stage at this stage? Because when this started, when, you know, they went into Israel and did these atrocities, you know, America, Britain, Australia, the usual mob just said, oh, they're very pro-Israel at the start, and now it's got a lot more complicated, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of like Israel's reaction has been seen to be an overreaction. And that, I think, is where they lost their moral authority, so to speak. And on one level, you can understand... Netanyahu also wasn't doing well in the opinion polls on home soil, But he's still being criticized for the fact that they haven't got the last of the Israeli hostages released. This is despite the fact that Qatar and indeed Egypt were working in the background to try and negotiate a deal. And it looked like Hamas were even interested in handing over some hostages if they got a ceasefire of a short duration or even a couple of weeks. And it was kind of scuppered at the last minute by Netanyahu. So I don't know where we are with that. Some of the Israeli hostages have been killed. And I would say, ironically, some of them may have died as a result of the air raids on Gaza.
Yeah.
It's statistically likely that one or two of them were in buildings that were hit by Israeli bombings, you know?
Yeah. And Netanyahu's popularity has slumped, it has to be said. And it is well known that he's not exactly honest with his people. I think their election system is very strange in that country. And I just wonder if he can survive this and is he being glorified in war? Because we both know that, you know, when you go to war as a country, I'm thinking of Churchill, even though he wasn't prime minister at the beginning of the Second World War, it does make a prime minister or president very popular, you know, but it doesn't seem to be working that way for Netanyahu with his so-called supporters.
Well, to back up your point, it looked like Margaret Thatcher in early 1982 was on her way out of office, and hey presto, along came the Falklands.
Indeed, lest we forget.
And that cemented the Tories in power until about 1997, you know?
Yeah, and of course she went out in 92, I think.
From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International.
Now, let's move on. European correspondent Declan Hughes, and we're talking about things that are going on in Europe. Now, I lived in Holland for a year. And I always see it as a peaceful place. So I was surprised to see in the Dutch news newspaper arrests and arson during Eritrean festival riots in The Hague is their headline. What is this about?
Well, interestingly enough, when we were kids, Eritrea was part of Ethiopia. And in fact, during the famous famine that produced Band-Aid, Eritrea was an integral part of Ethiopia. Now, since then, it's gotten its independence. They were a separate people. So they broke away from the Ethiopian regime using the fact that the Ethiopian regime, when it was ruled by the military, was a bit draconian, et cetera, as the pretext for their need to be independent. And now they have a draconian regime of their own. And what's happened here is the Eritrean festival in the Netherlands, from what I've been able to read about, was organized by a pro-Eritrean government organization. And the riots were caused by refugees who were fleeing their government, saying, not in our name sort of thing. And it's so basically what you have is you have an Eritrean civil disturbance transplanted onto the streets of the Netherlands, which the Dutch have nothing to do with. And That's basically what you're... And the Eritreans that were involved in the riot, that were the anti-government people, had genuinely fled from Eritrea because they felt they were being persecuted. So this is another... This reflects back to what I was talking about with the Irish situation a little bit, except this is what happens when two sides of a conflict end up in somebody else's country. And it's kind of like the Dutch have to clean up the broken glass afterwards.
And Marielle van Vulpen, who is the local police chief there, said, "Our colleagues were confronted with very serious violence which erupted out of nothing." Has this calmed down? Because this story is a week old, and I'm just wondering if this is all over and if the Dutch police force are effective, because they're probably not used to this, if you know what I mean.
Well, we're not seeing ongoing reports coming from since then. I mean, I haven't seen anything in the last two or three days about it. So it seems like they've managed to get it under control, and it might have been just a one-off. But it's interesting because, like, you know, the Dutch are reasonably welcoming, particularly for people they perceive to be in trouble. They've traditionally provided, you know, refuge to people who, other Europeans, for example. I mean, a classic example was before the Second World War. People like Anne Frank's family fled Germany, and they provided refuge for them up to the time the Germans invaded in 1940. And they've traditionally done that even right since their earliest years of independence. I think the Dutch and the Belgians got their independence in 1830, and the Spanish had been ruling the Netherlands for many, many years, and then there was a period where the Dutch were in control of what is now Belgium, and in 1830 we got the split where we have the modern day Belgium and the modern day Netherlands as they're presently constituted. But interestingly enough, Belgium was ruled by the Austro-Hungarian Empire for several hundred years and was known as the Austrian Netherlands, which I thought you might find interesting.
Yes.
And that's partly one of the reasons why I think the Dutch language survived so well there was because the overlords were Germans, and Germanic languages were not exactly frowned upon by the local Austrian overlord, shall we say. And indeed, to this day, there's a 250,000 native German speakers living in Belgium, and they see themselves as Belgian citizens, but German is their first language. And that's a legacy from the period of Austrian rule.
In Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first laid my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled her wheelbarrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, 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 oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels. She was a fishmonger, and sure 'twas no wonder, for so was her father and mother before. And they all wheeled their barrows through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh. She died of a fever, and no one could save her, and that was the end of sweet Molly. Ghost wheels her barrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels.
From the golden sands of Bondi Beach across your world.
You mentioned Mount Street earlier on in this broadcast, and it brought back memories, and I'm trying to avoid an anorex session going on here, but I worked on a station called Q102, the original Q102 in Dublin, and it happened to be on Mount Street. How are the commercial radio stations going in Dublin particularly? I know it's a very different story for people our age because, you know, we grew up and I worked in pirate radio. I just wonder, has it just all turned like ILR stations in the UK? And is it, do young people listen to FM radio, or are they just all on YouTube? Are the Dublin stations having an effect? Are they having problems?
Yeah, well, they're managing to retain a certain element of listenership, but realistically, they've all gone for this overly formatted music policy, which far more formatted than it ever was in your day, Henry, I have to say. Mm. The disc jockeys have no control over what's played at all.
Mm. Do they still have laws, you know, just like the ILR stations in the UK? Do they have laws where they have to have so much talk time every hour and needle time and all that sort of... can they play a whole record? Because I used to be able to on RT Radio 2, as it was known then.
There are laws. I'm not sure how strict they are because I haven't seen the updated versions. But there is a crowd called the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland that governs BCI. All broadcast. Yeah. Oh. And they now have... They now have the remit of doing the commercial and the state broadcasters. Now, a small percentage of the license fee that used to go almost exclusively to RTE goes towards commercial stations that are doing documentaries, and also community stations that are doing documentaries. So if they're doing a public service program for some reason on a commercial station, they can apply for a grant to fund this documentary. And a few of them do, in fairness, apply for these grants and they get them. But... and that would be mostly talk radio format and programming. Mm. And a lot of the local stations, particularly in the regions, would avail of this. But the situation, to get back to the core question you asked me, the problem is number one, 21st century music is by and large appalling. And it's mostly that music that's formatted onto the commercial radio stations. And they tend to play a very small playlist of the latest stuff, and a very small playlist of oldies, which is my biggest problem, because you tend to hear the same 50 or 60 oldies on every single radio station in the city. There's no variety whatsoever. You can almost predict what's going to be played. And a lot of the stations are also using a radio system which has pre-planned, and it's almost robot-like. They can actually do DJ-less music shows, which has a pre-ordered playlist, and every so often you'll get a jingle telling you what radio station you're listening to. And they'll have 1 and 2 hour-long programs of this kind of programming without a DJ coming on and saying what the name of the show is. But then you'll get station promos every 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And this kind of programming is becoming de rigueur. They tend to use it for late night shows on the big commercial stations, but you'll even find it on community radio stations. They won't bother hiring another presenter. They stick on this 2 hour generic chart show where they play the latest hits and they have station IDs every 10 minutes.
I've heard recently, or read recently, that Sky in the UK have started broadcasting onto commercial stations in Ireland, at least one show. Do you know about this? I think the boss of Nova, the CEO of Nova, was complaining in the Irish press about this.
Well, I'll tell you one situation which is akin to that, which I think is the only one I have any knowledge of. The former RTE presenter Ryan Tubridy got a gig with Virgin in England.
That's it, sorry. I said Sky, I meant Virgin, sorry, yes.
Yeah, and his show is relayed in two regional areas. One of the Dublin commercial stations puts a show of his out on a Saturday, and one in Cork. And the one in Cork has caused a lot of stir because the show that it's displaced or had reduced its airtime, shall we say, was a show that promoted local music. And a lot of people, and the presenter who hosted in Cork was extremely popular. And it's really put a lot of people's noses out of joint. And, you know, there's an expression in Northern Ireland that if somebody who already has a lot of publicity and a lot of money doesn't need any extra, it's called you don't rub fat to a fat pig's arse. And basically, giving Ryan Tubridy extra money from radio stations in Ireland to rebroadcast what he's doing in Britain is a little bit of rubbing fat to a fat pig's arse, because that guy was overpaid for decades in RTE. There's actually Dáil committees investigating RTÉ's overpayments to people and severance payments to people taking place in the Parliament at the moment because of the fact that RTÉ gets so much state funding, and it's been quite a scandal. But Ryan Tubridy's wages got exposed as part of this during his time. And in fairness to him, at least he had the neck to turn up and actually answer some questions at the committee, more than could be said for the former Director General, Dee Woods, who has used health concerns as the reasons why she can't answer questions as to why she signed off on some ridiculous payments to people, and indeed ridiculous severance payments to people. And until she actually signs a sworn affidavit and is accountable in some shape or form, I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of what actually happened in RTÉ at all.
Ryan Tubridy, of course, if you're listening outside Ireland, is, you know, he's a household name. I wonder, you know, he ran the Late Late Show, which is a flagship program on used to be on Saturdays, then went to Fridays.
Patrick Keating's in charge of that now.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering about Ryan Tubridy and what Gay Byrne, who was on The Late Late Show since the year you and I were born, 1962 is when The Late Late Show started. That's interesting. But the thing is, I wonder what Gay Byrne, if he was alive today, would think of Ryan Tubridy, or would he just think, well, that's... Because Gay Byrne thought about going over to the UK to broadcast back in the late 80s. He was offered a position. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, did you know he actually had a position in the 60s?
Yes, he started in Granada.
Yeah, but when he did the Late Late Show first, the reason why the Late Late Show was on Saturdays was because he used to come over to Dublin on a Friday night and host the Late Late Show on a Saturday, spend the Sunday with his wife and fly back to the UK on the Monday.
He
did that for the first 3 or 4 years of the Late Late Show, as far as I know.
Wow. Yeah, I wonder, you know, I do wonder why he never made the move. I mean, if you look at the likes of the late, great Terry Wogan, who really was BBC Radio 2 at the time, doing The Breakfast Show, you have to wonder where Gay went with that. And I know that he lived in North Dublin, on the north side of Dublin, and had, you know, loved Dublin, and he loved Ireland, and maybe that's and also maybe his children, I don't know, but he decided to stay, and I think we're all lucky that he did.
We are very lucky that he did, and he was probably the most influential broadcaster that that was around during his era, I think, for sure. Mm. I mean, there are issues that have, shall we say, made their debut on the Late Late Show that were never talked about in this country before during his
tenure.
Yeah, but like he started with like, so you say, relatively innocent stuff. Like there was a famous episode called The Bishop and the Nighty. I don't know if you remember that one.
And,
no. that was in the 1960s. It was kind of before the time, like there used to be a joke, there was no sex before television in Ireland, you know?
Yes.
Those kind of matters. And again, the lady that was wearing the nighty was actually married. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, it was kind of, say, shall we say, it was a very Roman Catholic approach to sex, put it that way. And yet there was a furore over it, you know. But they were talking about negligees and so these kind of things had never been discussed in public before, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, and that was the state of Ireland in the 60s and right through to the 80s. And, of course, Gay Byrne on The Late Late Show also interviewed gay people, you know.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal, wasn't it?
Mm. It was. And in fairness, like, he was always open to having interesting topics of conversation, whether he was in favour of them or not. And that was the beautiful gift he brought to bear. He says, this is a topic that's worthy of discussion. I may not agree with what some of these people say, but let's hear what they have to say anyway, you know. And that was his gift as a broadcaster. He was open-minded enough to say, this thing needs an airing.
Yeah.
Let's give it one and give these people a chance to give their side of the story. You know?
Even though he was the biggest personality in the country, he did have guts to do that because he was up against, for a start, the Catholic Church was basically running the government, and the government owned RTÉ, RTÉ.
Well, if you want me to basically date back when the Catholic Church became the government of Ireland, once Catholic emancipation came into law in 1829. The British did a deal with Cardinal Cullen, who at the time was the Archbishop of Armagh and the Cardinal of the whole island of Ireland. And basically, Catholic emancipation was given to Catholics in return for which the Catholic Church would keep the natives quiet. And for almost 100 years, they almost succeeded.
Gosh.
Why there wasn't a revolution after the famine, I will never know. But you have to put that down to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, you have to wonder about historical events like that dating back even to the mid to late 1700s.
So basically, the Catholic Church sold us out for the right to exist. Basically, is what happened.
You know, the Catholic Church is responsible for a lot of stuff that went on in Ireland. In fact, I know someone who, I think the laws have changed recently in the Republic of Ireland, where if you had a child out of wedlock and, you know, back in the 60s, let's say, and you put them out for adoption. Now, apparently, those who were put out for adoption can find their parents. Do you know about that? Because I know a case, in fact, my own stepmother had a child in the 60s, and I didn't know about it. And I was living with her and my father for some years as a teenager, and I did not know that she had had another child, and she met up with her recently, and it was a beautiful thing. Now, she's in her 80s, and the kid is now a 30-something-year-old, and now she's got grandchildren that she didn't know about.
Wow. Well, I mean, the thing is, there was an adoption, there's always been an adoption board, but one of the problems is when the adoption board was set up first, they weren't being given the information needed to be able to facilitate this sort of thing. And in recent years, the legislation has been changed. And there are sound medical reasons why you need to know who your birth parent is in case you inherited a genetic condition.
DNA, yes.
Exactly. So, like, there are sound medical reasons. So even if you're not prepared to meet your child from way back when, they need to have access to your medical records and what inherited conditions they may have, because they could carry forward a potential syndrome or a potential tendency to get a disease to their children and your great-great-grandchildren. Yes. And again, this information needs to be in their new families for, you know, information purposes that may prolong their life if these things are known about.
Yeah. Was Ireland way behind everyone with this? I'm so disconnected with Europe because I've been living in Australia for nearly 35 years.
I honestly don't know, because I'm not sure. I'm not familiar enough with where the Europeans were on these issues. I would imagine the Europeans were a bit more advanced than us. But again, there are several Roman Catholic countries in Europe that might have been almost in the same, shall we say, state of chastity, to quote a phrase from literature, that the Ireland adoption situation was in. And again, there were wholesale removals of children from this island to either Britain or the United States, facilitated by the Catholic Church at the time as well.
Declan Hughes, it's always so informative talking to you, and thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
You're very welcome, Henry.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Shows that count the most. Rick D's got Janet, Dan Ingram, and Casey.
Continuous Country, KYGO.
WMGK. The sound of Jam is everywhere you go.
Everybody, this is Henry from Bondi Tunes International. You're listening to our two-hour weekly chat show. But hey, we also have a music show called Bondi Tunes Plus, music from the 40s to the 90s, airing on this station. It's a big random party that spans five decades, from Nat King Cole to the Backstreet Boys and everything else in between. It's a lot of fun, so make sure you check your station's schedule and look out for the Bondi Tunes Plus show. I'm currently in the 40s, so I'm off to the dance hall. See ya.
Double-O-7, licensed to sing. The 1969 Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service provided a temporary break for Sean Connery, with George Lazenby making his one appearance as 007. And the song provided a temporary break from the tradition of having a title song over the opening credits. In fact, it wasn't even a title song. It arose out of the last words of that year's Bond entry, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, uttered by Bond after his wife's death, in both the novel and the film. Composed by John Barry with lyrics by Hal David, it was a secondary musical theme, the title theme being the instrumental On Her Majesty's Secret Service, also composed by Barry. Louis Armstrong, although ill at the time, was chosen by Barry to record the song because he felt he could deliver the title line with irony. The song was not registered in the music rating charts in the UK when first released, only becoming well-known 25 years later as part of a Guinness commercial after the Irish alternative rock band My Bloody Valentine chose to cover it for charity. Armstrong's version was then re-released and reached number 3 in the UK singles chart. When asked once for his favourite Bond composition, John Barry cited both We Have All the Time in the World and Goldfinger. Goldfinger because it perfected the Bond sound, and We Have All the Time in the World because he considered it the finest piece of music he had written for a Bond movie, and because of the pleasure of working with Louis Armstrong.
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life,
to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of the way will find us with the cares of the world far behind us. We have all the time in the world. Just for love, nothing more, nothing less, all love.
Bondi Tunes International in Australia, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney. Next hour, we'll be doing all things Australian. Melissa Greimer in Melbourne, Adam Devlin in Brisbane. We'll be talking about everything from shopping to politics. See you in 2 minutes.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.